Hi, good morning. Today, I am very fortunate to speak with Dave Smith, who I have never been able to speak to before because we have never met. And I am so appreciative that when I reached out to say, hey, will you talk to me about death? He said yes. And before we jump in, I just thought that it would be nice to hear about Dave Smith from Dave Smith.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Briefly, I am... I grew up around Dharma. So I grew up in Western Massachusetts, and I grew up down the street from Daniel Goleman, who's known as the emotional intelligence writer and author. And I was friends with his children. And him and his mom, my friend Hahnemann's mom, they were very close with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, and really a lot of the early IMS teachers. So I was introduced to that kind of thinking pretty early on. And no surprise here, my introduction to Dharma was through death. And I had a very bad car accident. Me and my girlfriend got run down by a drunk driver when I was 18. She was killed on impact and just left me there in a pretty traumatic state. And his family, I think, kind of caught on that there was something kind of off with me anyway, because there'd been some other death in my life. And mm-hmm. I was introduced to mindfulness right then, and but very soon after that. So that was in 1993 is when I was introduced to mindfulness, more Vipassana back then. And so my tradition is the Insight sort of Theravada school of mindfulness Vipassana practice, or early Buddhism is what I call it now. And after that, the last 25 years has been varied degrees of success with Dharma practice. For the first 10 years, I was struggling with drug and alcohol addiction, but I would also go sit these 10-day retreats. Mm-hmm. And then I got sober, and then I sat a long retreat. And then somewhere along the way, I ended up just kind of working in secular situations, working with teenagers and substance abuse, drug, alcohol addiction. And I started teaching mindfulness to the kids just because it seemed like I'm not a bad idea. And then that really launched me into my whole career now, where I was doing that. And then I trained with Noah Levine and Against the Stream and Vinny Ferraro and the Mind Body Awareness Project. And I did 6 years of teacher training with Against the Stream and was trained to teach retreats and classes and workshops. Mm-hmm. And then so that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years as a sort of a professional Dharma teacher. And I'm very interested in this topic. And I think the world is on a sort of global Dharma retreat right now because of the COVID. So I'm very grateful for the practice. Of all the things I've done, and I've done recovery, I've done therapy, I've done probably more self-help work than I'd like to admit. But Dharma practice has definitely been, specifically meditation, has been the most transformative thing that I've ever really been introduced to. And that continues to remain true.
Wow. That is so amazing. We think about the causes and effects that put us in certain circumstances. And so there you were down the street from some of these, amazing teachers, which, as a child, I'm guessing you didn't know they were amazing teachers. They were just like, that's just Dr. Goleman who lives down the street,
Yeah, it was just like my friend's dad and my friend's dad's family. They were just kind of cool, and they were nicer than my parents' friends. They were just, I could tell there was something going on with them that was
different. I will say that in another life, I teach some business classes. And so, yes, in a leadership class, we will talk about emotional intelligence and things like that. But I didn't realize until recent years that that a lot of his work came from mindfulness and Buddhism until I started really researching him more and reading his other things. And I was like, oh, well, no wonder this resonates.
You have to realize, if you look at the history, you have Daniel Goleman and Richard Davidson are sort of the science guys. Yeah. They were at those early Goenka retreats in the late 60s with Jack Kornfield and Sharon and Joseph and Stephen Batchelor and all these Dharma teachers. They were all in their early 20s sitting these Goenka retreats. Some of them went on to be Dharma teachers, and some of them went on to be scientists. But it was that initial introduction that inspired them to really look at the inner life from multiple perspectives.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And so you went through this difficult situation where you were in this accident and your girlfriend died. And do you remember at the time how that your initial response to death at that time? Was it rebellion, avoidance, denial, rage against it?
Sure. I do have to backpedal a little bit though, because before that there was other events. So if we go back to when I was 11, the initial event would be when I was 11 years old, my sister who was 15 was in a car on the way to school, and she was a passenger and the car tried to pass the school bus. So my sister was tragically killed in a car accident when I was 11. And that was, just devastating, horrifying. Yeah. My family still struggles with it up till to this day. Mm-hmm. And so from 11 to about 18, those were the worst years of my life. Being a teenager in the early 90s, feeling like I was treated weird, feeling like, why is everybody pretending like everything's okay? Clearly everything's not okay. And I think I had this stunted, I started doing drugs then, and I just was really, really, really suffering. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, I met my friend Hanuman, and I started to kind of become a Grateful Dead hippie. And then I started to think kind of positively about life for the first time in 6 years. And then bam, my girlfriend gets killed in a car accident, which really actually put me to the dark side.
Okay.
I was just like, the universe, there's no God. Mm-hmm. The universe is an unfair place. The universe obviously has some sort of something. The universe is clearly against me.
Yeah, against you personally.
So I had this kind of destructive existential philosophy view of like, I'm just, pardon my language, fuck everything. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. And that's what I did. So I became very entitled, very self-centered, very, if it's all a big nothing, then I'm just going to have fun. And I'm just going to party and do drugs and play music. And I'm going to do whatever I want. And if people don't like it, that's their problem.
So and kind of YOLO before it was YOLO, right? You only live once, like just do whatever the hell kind of thing. And so it sounds like you kind of embraced that. I'm going to just do. And in that, I'm just going to do whatever I want. No, I want to ask, because I'm guessing like no thought for the future, no thought for others. I may die from this. I may not. Who cares?
Yeah, it was really self-centered. It was really like self-serving, I would say.
Okay.
Nobody's done anything for me anyway. Mm-hmm. Nobody cares. It was a really kind of entitled kind of view of, and I wasn't like mean-spirited. I mean, I was fun to be around, but I was, I wanted to play music, and I had that kind of one focused concentration of like, I'm going to serve myself. And it wasn't all bad. Some of it was a little bit empowered, but I think it was actually a more of a constructive anger, because I wasn't trying to destroy things as much as I was just trying to have as much fun as I could.
Okay. Just thinking, well, let me get from this what I can. And at that point, did you think I'm going to die young anyway, or just not think about it?
I didn't even think about it. I actually felt a little bit invincible.
Okay.
I'd gotten hit by this car.
Right.
And had no injury. So I sort of had this, like, I can do whatever I want. I'm invincible. Kind of 18 years old too. So that's part of the equation anyway.
Yeah, we're invincible anyway. Yeah, you talk about those were awful years, and certainly because you had so many difficult things happen, I know I would never go back. People say, wouldn't you like to be young again? No. No, I would not. Thank you very much. No. It was horrible, angst ridden. So what was it that kind of brought you out of this? Was it like a sudden thing? Was it a gradual shift?
It's a little hard to remember, but I can say this much I know from trauma therapy work, is I think what happened, so the accident was actually on September 11th, interestingly enough, 1993, September 11th, 1993. November 30th, 1993 was when I went to IMS to meet my first Dharma teacher. So from September 11th till November 30th, I would say I was mostly in a highly dissociative state.
Okay.
I can't tell you much about what went on during that period of time, frankly. Mm-hmm. I think I was traumatized. I think that I was not really present at all. Sure. I don't think I had my wits about me. I think I just kind of did what I needed to get through the day. But I feel like I was just dissociative there, because I can't give you much of a, I don't have a much of a tape to play.
Absolutely.
Back.
That makes total sense.
Right. So then November 30th, I go to Insight Meditation Society at the request of Hahnemann's mom. And we spend the night at what's now the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. And then in the morning, a Dharma teacher named Stephen Smith, who I'm still very close with today, came over and he sat down with me 6 o'clock in the morning, still dark out, and said, you know, tell me about your experience. Mm-hmm. And I went on to tell him about my sister. And I just kind of gave him the litany of my autobiographical suffering. For some reason, I trusted this guy. I have no reason why. I really just trusted this guy. And we had this long conversation about the First Noble Truth, about dukkha, suffering. Mm-hmm. And he reframed my experience in a very interesting way, where he said, actually, there's a lot of wisdom that you have now, because your heart has been ripped open and you actually are experiencing suffering on a very real level. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it's like, this is how it is. This is the truth. Mm-hmm. This is part of life. And you've gotten a very, very poignant, specific sense of that. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, what do you want to do about that? Uh-huh. And he said meditation can help. And then he introduced me to mindfulness practice a couple hours later. Uh-huh. But actually, I think something happened in that day, in that event with him, where I think my dissociation went away and I kind of came back online.
Okay.
Because when I first practiced mindfulness, I listened to him, I talked to him, I trusted him. I felt like he was the first adult in my entire life who sat down and was just telling me the truth. He totally validated and normalized my experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's like, of course this is, of course you feel the way you feel. How could you not? And then we would do the mindfulness and he'd say, bring your attention to breathing, and my mind would wander. And he'd say, notice when your mind wandered and come back to the breath. And I did that for, you know, maybe 10 minutes. And mm-hmm. I got this epic, actually life-changing experience where I realized that all of the suffering that I was experiencing in my life was actually just in my mind.
Oh, that's pretty amazing for your, I'm going to say, first, it seems like you're like your first time out meditating, and what an amazing experience.
So I got introduced to the idea that the mind is a thing that's actually different than my sensory awareness.
Okay. Okay.
So he would say, you know, I would get caught up in the stories and the betrayal and the resentments and the why me's and all that. But if I paid attention to my breathing, that actually went away, and I'd be in sensations of the in and out breath, and I'd feel temperature and I'd feel my body, which wasn't ecstasy by any stretch, but I recognized in a very experiential Dharma way that there was relief to be had in the present moment if I just hearkened my attention in a different way.
Oh, okay.
And that in people, we learn this, people learn this stuff every day. And I still take it for granted, but mm-hmm. just the power, the transformative power of the mind, by just having that kind of experience of like, okay, these are all thoughts and memories, and this is all self. This is all this kind of construction of my mind. And mm-hmm. there's other things going on that aren't that. And I have in that moment, I can choose. And I don't think I've ever gotten a Dharma transmission that has ever come as close to a power of that particular one.
You know, and as you're saying it, I'm thinking, you know, he's so right. And I'm feeling now like, I wonder how often when I sit, am I just taking it for granted? And if I would kind of just go back and revisit what you just said, I think it would just make it more powerful each time, because right. I think you're right. Sometimes when we've practiced, we take it maybe for granted, or even maybe take for granted what we think it, I'm going to use the word should, right? What it should be doing for us. And gosh, that seems dangerous now. I think that anything taken for granted, maybe because
it is dangerous. So we forget, yeah. You know, and you've been practicing for a long time. You teach, you talk about it. Yeah. That you just kind of, we can make these assumptions that this is just how it should be, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't understand that we have already have overcome so much. And so, you know, I think that I try to push that message in my teaching. Mm-hmm. And I try to remind myself daily that, you know, this, you know, I don't have to do this. I get to do this.
True.
I get to live a life that's actually informed by a practice that has transformative powers that are verifiable from my own direct experience. It's not mystical. It's not otherworldly. It's not theoretical. It's not abstract. It's liberation available in every single moment if I just choose to participate in that kind of way. And to me, that's just very, that's a very encouraging idea.
Why do you think it's hard for us to make that choice? Because as you talk about it, I'm like, yeah, of course he's right. And you know, why don't we make that choice every day? Because as a human being, I can't promise you I make that choice every day. Do I try?
Well, we get caught up. We get caught up in the minutia, and the mind has a momentum to it that's, I think, natural and neurobiological. And we get caught up in the political landscape. We get caught up in, you know, all kinds of stupid, irrelevant things. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, because we have an exit door. It's just, I think it's hard work, you know, and sometimes we do have to be on the computer, and we have to email, and we have to deal with money. We're not monastics. Right. You know, I suspect you have mortgages and car payments like the rest of us. And
I do.
You have to get caught up in that stuff. Otherwise, yeah, you're going to be in big trouble. So I think it's just trying to balance that. The question is, when you're done paying the mortgage and the car payment and putting the groceries away, can you sit down and unhook from it?
Yes. And you know what?
Can you clock out?
Some days but you know what? I know there are some days that I do not. And I can feel it. And on those days that I do not, they do feel so much more different than the days when I do. And the days when I do are just full of so much more peace and lightness and, mm-hmm, you know, all those things. Absolutely.
So, you know, that's why we call it a practice, right? We practice that.
I think that's always been one of the things that's the biggest relief to me, is knowing that I don't have to know everything all the time.
Oh yeah, right, definitely.
Yeah, that's like such a relief to me.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've gone through these experiences, and then somebody comes to you who you trust, and they teach you the first noble truth, and you begin to sit in the present moment. And then I think you said you went on a 10-day retreat. Mm-hmm. And then that at some point, and so now you have to let me know if it's okay to discuss this, and if it's not, I'll.
Yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy to talk about anything. I'm totally open.
And so, but so then at some point though, there, you still worked with addiction. And I, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about that, because I think this is a thing that is helpful and important to people. But yep, if you don't want to, we can edit it out.
No, it's fine. It's important, I think. So what I've learned in the last maybe 10 years is that, uh-huh, I have no problem admitting that I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict. I can go to an AA meeting and say, my name's Dave, I'm an alcoholic. I don't have a problem with that at all. Uh-huh. But what I've learned is that it's not so much that I have addiction. It's actually that I have trauma. And addiction was my solution or my medication, mm-hmm, to dealing with the trauma. Mm-hmm. Because even though I did these practices and I did get some relief, I still had some stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And what, like I said at the beginning, the self-centered entitlement, I wasn't trying to destroy my life with drugs and alcohol. I was just having fun.
Okay.
Okay. And I would go sit retreats in, mm-hmm, the summer, and I was very polarized because I definitely loved the Dharma. I had romantic notions about becoming a monk and giving up the world. I knew the world was hollow and vacant and there wasn't anything there, but mm-hmm, it was really fun. So I kind of got batted around like that for about 10 years.
From one to the other. Was it easy to be sober on a retreat?
Yes, it was, ironically.
Okay. Because it was such a clear, like, this is how it is. And so
I had a tremendous amount of respect for the retreat experience that I didn't, uh-huh, want to, and it was a precept, you know, at the time. And I just respected the form and the, mm-hmm, container that I wanted to participate with it. Maybe it was hard a little bit, being on retreat so hard anyway.
Well, yeah. It was easy. We'd all do it all the time. That's true. You know, I guess as we're speaking, there's something I'm kind of remembering, being back in my 20s and the partying And I think one of the ways I thought about it was that there was a point at which some of us, I think, were able to step away from the partying because, you know, you mentioned, oh, I was just partying, right? I was just having fun with the alcohol. And so with some of my friends and I, with the drugs and the alcohol, yeah, we were just having fun. This is what we did on a weekend or something. But as I got older, I began to see that some of us stepped away from it, but some of us weren't able to step away from it. And then that's when it wasn't so fun anymore.
Right.
And, you know, with one of those friends, when he moved forward and he decided to join a program, and he became a 12-stepper, one of his challenges was the concept of the higher power, because he was an atheist.
Sure.
It was a concept of a higher power. And I don't know if, you know, is this an area where today, what would you tell somebody today that was having that problem? Because it seems like the rest of the program can be so good.
Right. Well, you know, there's a couple of things I could say. It's A, there's, you know, there's God and then there's higher power. Mm-hmm. I think God is actually a lot harder for people like your friend.
Yes.
A higher power, I think, is, and I would actually pluralize it and say higher powers.
Okay.
So there's the higher power of awareness. There's the higher power of compassion. There's the higher power of gratitude. There's all these innate human qualities that mm-hmm. are, I could say they're powers greater than ourselves because they're universal. Mm-hmm. And so I find it very easy when I teach people in recovery and in my own practice, like, yeah, I have no problem subscribing to powers that are greater than myself. And actually, embracing those and practicing those and allowing that those things are going to allow me to become the person that I want to be. I think that that's a lot easier of a framework for like an atheist to get into mm-hmm. than trying to do the whole God thing. But the word higher power and the word God both show up. So you do kind of get to choose how you hold that.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I remember one time he told a story and eventually he becomes a Buddhist and actually we became Buddhists together. But at one point he said somebody pulled him aside and said, you know what, your higher power could be a doorknob. Just get over that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you got to get over it. You know, when you have bigger, when you're struggling with addiction, yeah. you have bigger fish to fry than these concepts.
Yeah, and so, so that helped him quite a bit. Mm-hmm.
But also for me, that was hard about it was I was a musician. I was playing in ska, punk, and reggae bands in Boston. Mm-hmm. Not only was it something I did in my 20s, but it was very much a part of that lifestyle. It was like, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't have a job and I sold drugs and I did drugs. My lifestyle, my whole life was built around this identity of sort of rock star, anti-establishment. So it was really, really part of my existential way of being that it wasn't something mm-hmm. I did like on the weekend after work. I didn't work. I didn't have a job till I was in my almost my 30s.
Okay.
So that was my job, sort of was my thing. And I did whatever I had to do to make it work. And I lived in crappy apartments with plenty of people. And we just lived that kind of, you know, punk rock alternative lifestyle that afforded us the luxury of not having to work.
Yeah. I guess I do think that when we give, we being the societal we, I guess when we start giving rock stars the permission to be more conservative and to not be drug addicts or alcoholics and to admire them for it, I feel like we don't do that until they are older, until they've walked through a fire and been the ones who lived. And then all of a sudden, you know, you become a rock star in your maybe late 40s, 50s and beyond. Then we're like, oh, it's so cool. She finally got sober. And, you know, now look at her. But, you know, I think it is an image that we place on you when you are in that world. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like there's this dues paying of this, you know, and how cool would it be if we didn't do that? But I guess that's a topic for another day. So sure. Now when people come to you who are going through grief and facing death, what would you tell them? How would you help them?
Well, it's hard because, you know, death is such an interesting thing because it's kind of one of the most obvious things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not rocket science. It's not difficult concept to grasp it. You know, even kids at some point, everybody knows everybody dies. We all know we're going to die. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of denial around that. It's obvious and actually natural and one of the most normal things. But when confronted with it, it's one of the most painful things. So it's kind of got that both end of like, it's really, we know it, but we don't, we know that we're going to die. Mm-hmm. We know that death is real, but we don't know how to deal with it. So this is, it's a know that versus a know how.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, I know that my sister's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea how to deal with it when it happens.
Mm. Okay.
So part of, I think, what I is a is that that's a, I think, a useful framework for people who are in it. But I think the hard part for a lot of people is that unless you've had that experience yourself, people tend to not be that helpful. So the tendency is to be is to reassure people, oh, everything's going to be okay,
mm-hmm.
or they're in a better place, or the kind of consolation, reassuring. And the person who's actually in the grief and the loss, that's the last thing they want to hear because it sounds very condescending.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So trying to be in a compassionate space of a kind of feeling with, resisting the urge to try to fix their experience, to reassure their experience. But really, I think it's hard. The work is trying to validate or normalize or actually empathize with it. Like, I understand how you feel because I have been in that experience myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And before you, our culture, we always want to move on to the remedy, right?
Yeah,
we always want to move on to the fixing. And there has to be a period of time where people are allowed to be in the sadness and be in the mourning and be in the loss and suffer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the one thing about, that was the one message I got from Dharma practice, which is really confusing because I think Buddhism doesn't do a great job of this because we come into Buddhism and think, oh, we're going to end suffering, the path that leads to the end of suffering. And people get fixated on the end of suffering. You know, I don't believe in the end of dukkha myself. I think it's our job is to embrace it. So what the message that I got from Dharma and that I continue to get from it is I'm actually allowed to suffer.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's permission. I feel like that Dharma teacher gave me a permission slip. You're allowed to suffer whenever you want, however you want, for as long as you want, for as long as you need to. Because our culture doesn't like it. You know, somebody, you know, in a group therapy setting or somebody cries, we hand them a box of tissues, which feels like a polite thing, but it's actually very condescending of like, you know, kind of get your shit together. Like, I don't want to see your sadness. Clean it up.
You know what? Thank you so much. You are so right. And I had a conversation yesterday with someone who is, you know, has also been a widow. And we were talking about things like that and how at some point we realized that our job with other people was to say, I'm fine, even though we weren't fine. And you know, what she was sharing was, you know, one of the things that's the most helpful is if you have somebody who can do some of the things that you just mentioned, which are to just, she didn't say it this way, I'm going to say it this way, just shut up and be there with me, you know, and don't, yes, like you said, don't try to fix it. And I know when it was my turn, I realized that there were times when I had said these, and I feel so horrible. I had said these horrible.
Well, it's the cultural norm.
That were reassuring.
Yeah, it's the cultural norm. It's what you were taught to do.
Yeah, it'll be okay. I mean, when I was younger and I wasn't sure about my belief system, I would utter the "he's in a better place" thing because
that's like the meanest thing to say to somebody who just lost somebody.
But that doesn't help them because most of us weren't worried. Like when my husband died, I wasn't worried if he was in a better place. Like I knew he was okay. I wasn't okay.
Yeah, it's very dismissive of your own subjective experience. And you know, that's why Buddhism, you know, if you put all the religions on a world stage, Buddhism is the most uncomfortable character on that stage because religion essentially is about consolation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're going to die, but it's okay because this is going to happen. Or, well, what religions typically do is they console your deepest fears about life. Buddhism's not interested in that at all. Buddhism Buddhism is going, yeah,
it hurts.
Totally. Yeah. Be like, you know, like, this is how it is. Mm-hmm. And you can develop practices and you can develop strategies. And you know, there's lots of, you know, lots of different Buddhist ideas and frameworks and concepts. But ultimately, it's all about an acceptance towards that which is most painful. Mm-hmm. And actually, for many of us, for most of us, that ourselves, but of the people that we care about. And that's why when people talk about, you know, they want to get into Buddhism because they hear that you can end suffering, I think they get it backwards. I think it's like you can learn to live with suffering, actually.
Exactly. You've got to, and you know, so I'm clearly, I'm not an enlightened being. And so, you know, I haven't alleviated suffering and gone beyond on any of those things. I think people miss the part of to get, let's just even say better with suffering. Let's not even say go beyond suffering.
Sure.
You have to face the suffering. Yeah. It's not like I can just go, oh yeah, that's right. That noble truth is right. There's suffering. I've had suffering. Okay, I'm ready.
Next.
I'm ready.
Next. You know, what's the next
one? Is there like a powder and I could make a smoothie out of it? And then every morning I can drink my I'm getting over suffering smoothie.
Yeah, see, that's the difference between the two. You know, there's that dogma, right?
Yeah.
Buddhism doesn't really have a dogma. It has a pragmatic. So it's not a no. Again, it's to me, Dharma is not a know that. I know. Do you know that people die? Yes, I know that.
Yes.
Do I? Yeah. Knowing that actually doesn't help me at all. Mm-hmm. It's do I know how? Do I have any skills? Do I have any abilities? Do I have the ability to open to these things, to embrace that?
Yeah.
That's the know-how. And that's what we're training for. We're training the know-how. We're not just subscribing. That problem, of course, Buddhism full of lists, and everybody wants to memorize all the lists because they think that'll mean something. And I think that it's also culturally the way that we do things. It's about skills, and it's about being able to do things in a meaningful way, rather than just having some understanding.
That's a relief because I'm a great forgetter of the lists.
Great.
I know sometimes people will come at me like, you know, it's la, la, la. I'm like, is there a test? No. So what do you think are those skills? What can we put in our death preparedness toolkit?
Yeah. I mean, I think it varies from person to person, but I think there's not a great way. Of course, in Buddhism, we use this word equanimity, which is pretty good, but there's not an English equivalent that's great. Ultimately, I think at its very core, it's the ability to develop acceptance.
Ah, okay.
And also being able to acknowledge and to accept the reality of loss.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to open to and access the emotion of sadness, which most people are not interested in doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, ironically, if you look at the research around emotions, is if you look at the difference between sadness and grief, grief is sort of a repression of sadness. Grief goes on and on and on because it's the narrative that we have about that. Uh-huh. And it can go on forever. Sadness is the ability to access the emotion. It's to feel the sadness, to mm-hmm. feel the tightness in the throat, to allow the weeping and the tears to come, to actually let sadness express itself mm-hmm. the way that it would like to. But a lot of times we hold that back and we cling and we restrict. And that's really where I think the people talk about, in clinical world, people talk about grieving in a way I think that's not so great. Because I think that we, you know, the way out of grief is actually feeling sadness.
Doesn't
make a lot of sense, I think, on paper. But people are very, sadness is not a comfortable emotion for many people. We don't like talking about it.
True.
And where do we talk about sadness? We pay somebody $250 an hour to go sit in a private room behind a closed door with a noise machine on the floor so we can talk about sadness. So then we feel shame about our sadness.
So much truth in that. I so appreciate you bringing that up because it's, you know, you think about like, why do we do that? Well, we do that because we're taught not to talk about it in public So you either have to kind of self-ostracize, which is damaging to a lot of people, or, you know, if you don't have a friend that you can share it with. And then I feel like you're taught that, okay, you have 90 days. I always felt like there was this imposed 90 day limit. And, you know, in 90 days, you were going to be fine. And you're not fine in 90 days.
I mean, my sister died on a Monday and I was back at school the following Monday.
Yeah. Right. Cause you just.
I'm 11 years old. My sister died a week ago and now I'm doing long division.
Right. Right. Let's get his life normal as soon as possible.
Yeah, so there's that denial, that sweeping under the rug, that avoidance, that repression. And I think that that's really, that's the most destructive aspect here, because sadness as an emotion, which we all have, is a universal experience. Everybody mm-hmm. has sadness. Mm-hmm. And sadness is all about loss. And it's all about trying to find connection in the face of loss. Mm-hmm. And if I don't have anybody that I can connect to when I'm in loss, I'm in big trouble.
Yeah.
And so compassion, you know, is sort of the Buddhist antidote to that. But compassion is usually done relationally. Now, if somebody close to me dies, can I sit down and have self-compassion for myself? I don't know, maybe. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and then it becomes an antidote, right? Like if you don't wanna, compassion becomes the antidote for the sadness. Mm-hmm. But that's not really right either, because it's both. It's not like if you have compassion and the sadness will go away, which is the deal that people make in Buddhism. They go, well, if I have compassion, then I won't be sad.
I think that is a thing that I had to learn, was that no matter where I was in my practice, I realized that there was going to be a point, because this was, I'll say before, you know, some of my family members died, as I started realizing like, hey, people are going to die, you know, your parents are in their 80s, people are going to die, that I had to realize that I felt like I could only get to a certain point of preparation, and that it was going to be hard, and I was going to be sad, but that I was going to get through it, and that my practice was going to help me get through it, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't the vaccine.
No, and you're saying the right word. It's through it. It's not underneath it, around it, over it. It's through it.
Oh.
You know, you have, and who wants to go through that? Nobody wants to go through that.
Right.
Right. You know, so it's just like, so then now we're just talking about aversion, right? Like, yeah, I have aversion to feeling the sadness about the death of my loved ones. Well, join the club, right? But you know what? That aversion is not going to be helpful.
That's true. You just have, when I say have to, no one has to do anything, but this is what I say when I feel strongly, you just have to let it unfold, I guess. That's how I felt. Like I had to let it unfold and use my practice to help me. But I know there was a time for a minute, and thank goodness I spoke early on to one of my local, you know, meditation teachers, because there was a time early on when I had this, am I a bad Buddhist?
Yeah.
I'm sad. I'm crying.
Oh, that's classic.
Am I a bad Buddhist? Did I not get it?
Yeah, I know. That's so tragic.
But then I had to realize, no, you're just a human Buddhist. And I think one time I read somewhere, even though I don't come from the Tibetan practice, I think I read somewhere that the Dalai Lama said that even he cried when his mother died.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that, again, that's my big pushback against the Buddhist world, is that, I mean, if somebody close to you dies and you don't cry and you don't feel sad, that's really unhealthy.
Yeah, I feel like that would be, that's being broken.
Yeah, or just being cold or indifferent or shut down. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's what we call in a clinical sense, that's just repression.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a term that they use sometimes called spiritual bypass. And American Buddhists think that that's why they get into it. They're like, oh, I can avoid all this terrible stuff if I become enlightened. And then they chase down that idea, which I think is very prevalent in American Buddhism, and I think it's one of the top three reasons why I do what I do, is because mm-hmm. I think that that's not healthy. And again, so Buddhism's declared, American Buddhism for sure, has declared a war on suffering. Suffering, you're a bad Buddhist. You're obviously not doing it right. You didn't get it. And I think that that's actually totally false.
Thank you so much. Yeah, there's somebody, as you're talking, there's someone that who is not a teacher, a person who's going through their own path and follows a different tradition. And sometimes when this topic comes up, one of the things he'll say repeatedly, and once in a while, our teacher will gently break in and suggest a different approach, but he'll say, no, the answer is just cut off your feelings, cut it off. And I'm like, no, I think the answer is to have the feeling.
Well, cutting it off sounds pretty violent to me.
Yeah, it frightens me in a way. It frightens me for any of us as individuals, and it frightens me if anyone in the room is paying attention. But now I'm going into judgy territory, so I'll just stop. But I'll just say, I feel like, I don't think it's cutting off emotions, it's greeting them and sitting with them and learning this is what it is, this is what sadness is. And So as you teach in some of your teachings, how do you teach people about suffering, death being, grief being part of it?
Yeah, I try to, I think that, again, I think that they get it. I think a lot of it's backwards. It's not, I actually think suffering is doesn't do the heavy lifting when we're talking about Buddhism. Uh-huh. I think Buddhism is about being happy.
Okay.
I think it's about being happy and having a meaningful life.
Okay.
And developing the life that's authentic to you, and mm-hmm. having the best life that you can in spite of all the suffering.
So what
suffering does is it creates limits and it creates obstacles and it blocks us from being happy. So it's not about getting rid of it. It's about, when you're planting a garden, what's the most important part of the garden? The stinky chicken poop, nasty fertilizer. Now, your suffering is your soil. And so you don't want to, what grows, if you plant a tomato seed in beautiful white Malibu beach sand or stinky chicken, poopy, nasty stuff, what's it going to grow better in?
Oh my gosh, thank you. That is a beautiful analogy.
So the suffering is actually your fertile. There's a lot of nutrients in that. And it's mm-hmm. just a matter of, it's just an attitude thing. Like, it's like, do you see it that way or do you not see it that way? And so then from there, so if I can accept that and I can embrace that and I can give myself permission to be sad, to experience loss, if I can just open to that as being part of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can plant different seeds and I can tend to this cultivation of, that's the word for meditation is bhavana, which means to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha is always talking in agricultural terminology. In part of the garden, part of the delicious tomato or the delicious avocado mm-hmm. is actually the nasty, crappy soil that it grew in.
So I have to be willing to work in that nasty manure and, when I will get hands on in the nasty manure, then I'm going to see the blooms.
And also from my experience, uh-huh. the nastier you manure, the better the fruit. So if you've really had a lot of suffering, good for you.
Ah, there you go.
You got like organic, grass-fed, free-range suffering.
I've got grade A stacks of steer manure.
Yeah, you got, you're already ahead of everybody else.
That is so awesome.
Because you've embraced it. You've understood that this is part of it. And I think that there's a backwards view on that. And so, and there's even documented science research on the same idea too. So
it's about
being whole. It's not about being good.
Ah, okay.
And if you're looking at the whole picture, like they talk about right view in Buddhist practice, right view. Right view is a complete view. So are you including everything in the view, or are you trying to control and avoid and dictate? Clearly death, I mean, everybody knows that. Clearly death is part of life.
Mm-hmm.
So any denial or repression or avoidance of that is obviously not going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what else would you want to share with others? Because I have been hogging your time for a while now, and I'm enjoying it. I would want to talk to you forever, but I also would like you to have your beautiful life. And
I get it. I'm happy to talk about this. This is important. Very important. You know, I think that people, when they come into Buddhist practice or Dharma practice, I think that there always has to be some critical thinking. And I think that we really have to understand that Buddhism has actually, I think, declared a war against suffering. Suffering is bad and wrong. And if you were doing Buddhism right, you wouldn't be suffering. You actually mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
A bad Buddhist.
Yes.
And that you if that's the thinking, then you've missed the whole point of this work. So however you can kind of battle with that, I think is important. And so, and a lot of it is really comes down to a loss, and we lose lots of things, not just about death. Every moment there's a death, right?
Yes.
When you and I click off this Zoom, this conversation will have died.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you're gonna reincarnate it later in a book, which is kind of cool.
Yes, I am. And in audio. Yes.
So you know, we lose jobs, we lose family members, we lose animals, we lose it all. And so that's part of impermanence. I mean, isn't that like Buddhism 101, impermanence? Yes.
Impermanence,
And so because the emotion, if the hallmark is impermanence, the proper emotional response is sadness. So you need to learn how to be sad. You need to learn how to feel shame. You need to learn how to access everything that came in the hard drive. And that's why Dharma practice and mindfulness is so good. It's the vehicle that you can explore all the tricky, bizarre, scary, beautiful territories of the human experience. It's about being whole, not about being good or pleasant, or it's the whole gamut. And so if you have some awareness skills and some compassion skills and some kindness skills, if you've developed some of these Buddhist skills, you can take them with you into these very difficult territories, and you can look around, you can be with those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it might take your whole life, and you might actually never be able to do all of it.
Right. And I think that is okay, obviously, but when I say I think that's okay too, what I mean is, I think that is also a beautiful thing, to have something that we can do all our lives, but not be obsessed with, when am I finished? When am I crossing the finish line?
There's no yellow ribbon.
Not have to be obsessed about that.
There's definitely no yellow ribbon.
Absolutely. So is there something, this is a weird question I always ask, is there something I should have asked you that I didn't ask you? You're like, Margaret, why didn't you ask me?
No, I think nothing jumps off the page.
Okay.
One thing that I would like to add that I don't think you would have asked me, that maybe you'll ask future people after I mention it, is trying to understand the relationship between sadness and joy.
Oh, thank you.
That the one thing about the Dharma system that I think is true, that I think there's lots of things in life we could say are totally unfair, but the Dharma system seems to be fair. And so this is why it's about happiness. I think my ability to accept and to embrace the sadness and the tragedy of my life is equally correlated to my ability to express and to embody and to access the joy and the happiness in my life.
Oh, okay.
And you can't selectively numb.
Okay.
So if you can experience, if you can only experience sadness at a two, then you can only experience joy at a two. But if you can experience sadness at a nine, you can experience joy at a nine. They're not really that different, actually. And that's the equanimity, the understanding that it's both and life. That's the Buddhist perspective. Life is both tragic and beautiful. And sometimes you're in the tragedy of life, and sometimes you're in the beauty of life. And even when there's something tragic happening, there's something beautiful happening. And that's the gestalt of Dharma. Like, you know, you look at the gestalt picture, and is it two candles or two heads? Well, it depends how you look at it. You've seen these gestalt images, right? Where you look at it, you're like, yes, no, it's two candles. And you do that little funny thing with your eyes, and then it's two heads.
Yes.
And then, what is it? Well, it depends. It depends how you look at it.
Yes. That is so helpful. What you have just done is, I believe, for me, thank you so much, is to really help put some more meat behind that concept of to accept death is to really live. But by showing that, you know, if you to feel things at the same level, no matter which part you think it is, I would say we tend to think joyfulness is better than sadness. But those are conventional human phrases. That's the only way I know how to put it into words. I don't know that that's really the heart of Buddhism. And that is really helpful because, you know, I do believe that to embrace death is to embrace life. And that's just another great analogy to help with that point, is to embrace emotions at the same level, no matter the emotion.
Right. Otherwise, we're just dictated by our preference system, which is not great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be happy all the time, don't you? Of course I do. But, you know, that's not how it, that doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It's causes and conditions, you know, and if the conditions are that of loss and difficulty, and then sadness is actually the appropriate thing to be feeling.
So to go all in. Go all in with whatever it is. Notice that here's this feeling. This is what it is. I can remember times, and I don't know if it was that way for you, but where I would just realize, today I'm going to be sad. And I wasn't like dictating that to myself, like, it's Tuesday, Margaret, it's sad day. I just would feel it and say, oh, okay, today is sadness. And that didn't mean all of the day was sadness.
No.
It just meant like that morning when I woke up, I'm like, oh, today is going to be sadness. Yeah. And then I would proceed about my day accordingly. And I'll say, have expectations of my ability to function, if you will, based on today I'm having sadness.
Right. It's a universal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're very universal.
That is great. What else? Is there anything else you want to make sure that we know?
No, I feel pretty good. I think that was good.
That was so great. Well, I want to thank you again. I really appreciate that when I reached out to you, you said yes. And everything you've said here today is going to be so helpful to people.